So I'm going to ask you to get a comfortable position and close your eyes. And to get us grounded, I'd like you first to imagine that right in front of you is a great ball of white heat and energy. And this ball of white heat and energy is there for you. And I want you to breathe it in and breathe it all through your body. Just breathe in the energy. Now I want you to remember when you were 9.
10.
Or 10. Just remember a place that you loved to go to when you were a child. Some place you went to be alone. See if you can put yourself there and look around you. See what you see. And smell whatever smells there are there. Listen to what you can hear in this special place. Now imagine that you're in your special place and you're all by yourself and you're thinking your special thoughts that you don't tell to anyone else. Just take a moment to remember what you thought. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes and come back into the circle. Did you get back to being a child? Can you feel that? Feel that special place? I would invite you right now just to give yourself a few words or images in your mind to keep that special place. To remember that so you can go back there later on. Getting to that special place is a lot of what poetry is about. Some people are a little scared by poetry because it doesn't look like stories. And poetry is different from stories. But one of the differences between a poem and a story is where a story wants to tell you something about what happened. A poem most often wants to bring you into what it felt like to be there. What it felt like to be that person at that time. Beth, are you ready to read the poem?
Something.
Okay, if you don't want to read that one, I'll read a different
one. Not right now.
Okay, do you want to read it through?
First,
I need to be able to get on with the session. Anybody want to talk about what it was like back at your special place? Mike?
Sure, it was a lot of imagination. I thought about they just made a new baseball field behind the woods behind my house. So there was a pile of dirt sort of in the woods, on the edge of the woods. And I would always imagine building just this immense sandcastle out of this pile of dirt that was sort of fresh and still could be molded. Never got around to it, but it was fun to imagine just all the intricacies of a sandcastle and what you could do with them where.
It's probably as good to imagine it as it would have been to build it, maybe better.
Yeah.
Anybody else want to talk about what your special place was like?
Well, mine was just a hill behind my babysitter's house. It was like this
sliding hill in the winter, you know, it's a huge, really steep thing. And I just used to sit up there and with my friends, I guess, more mm-hmm. than myself very much.
You sat on top of the hill. Mm-hmm. Did you slide down it too, or was it?
In the winter.
In the winter, yes. But in the summer, you just sat on top of the hill and looked out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a huge plain, you know, in front of it and behind it. So.
Anybody else?
There was an attic in one of the houses we lived in, and I'm not sure it might have been younger than mm. it was a place that we started to go up to sometimes with my sister. It was a real imaginative place. We had lots of neat stuff up there too, like dress-up clothes mm-hmm. and things that you could make mm-hmm. Things out of, and it was sort of supposed to be our place, but it was a real neat place to lay down under the eaves and mm-hmm. look out the window or down three stories.
I think an attic is a wonderful image for the imagination. Sort of, you think of the attic of your mind as the place where you put all your old stuff and you go up there and you play with it. You try things on in your imagination. Yeah, that's a nice one. Anyone else want to share?
Yes.
When I close my eyes, I felt the love coming back to me, and I was I went to the store when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. So I have this picture of my this huge store.
Were you, you saw all the things in the store?
Yeah.
I remember that feeling of being a child, and the store was so exciting. So there was all this stuff in the store. Is that what it felt like?
Yeah.
Was it exciting?
Yeah.
Yeah. A drugstore?
With my friend. Mm-hmm. We collected stickers and collected candy and
anyone else want to share your special place?
My grandfather had a lumber yard, and it was a huge storage shed. We weren't supposed to, of course we did, up where they stored the lumber. Up real high, and you could hide and look down the grown-ups, and they looked real small.
The grown-ups looked real small. I like that. That's
nice.
Are you ready to read? Okay, let's let Beth read Young. You want to read this one instead? Okay, go ahead and read that one then. This one's called Birthplace. Go ahead and read it.
I've never seen the place where I was born. The place my mother laid down beneath the ceiling,
her womb?
Her womb.
A cumbrous?
Cumbrous load. The first tick-tocking to my small heart still live in the chimney fittings and the crannies of the old bricks, and they're still visible on the door and the walls. Is that look of shame, my mother's look, and at my father, and my grandfather? A choked voice murmured, "It's a girl." The midwife trembled, unsure of her birthing fee, and goodbye to the
circumcision feast.
Circumcision feast. The first visit I make to my birthplace, I'll peel from the walls the shamed look of my mother, where the bold rhythm of my pulse began. I'll make confession, my clear hands bear no urge to clench and strike. Brawling drunk is into my language. I take no pride in killing male
supremacy,
never feigning its table.
Thank you, Beth. That is a poem by a woman called Tahira Safarzadeh. It's a poem by a woman who was born into an Islamic culture where being born a girl was a shame and where the midwife wasn't sure she was going to get her birthing fee because the baby that was born was a girl. Interesting poem. Let me read you the Anne Sexton poem, and as I read it, I want you to think about how Sexton expresses her special place, her childhood place. Thank you, Beth. That was very nice. Sexton's poem is called Young. A thousand doors ago, when I was a lonely kid in a big house with four garages, and it was summer as long as I could remember, I lay on the lawn at night, clover wrinkling under me, the wise stars bedding over me. My mother's window, a funnel of yellow heat running out. My father's window, half shut, an eye where sleepers pass. And the boards of the house were smooth and white as wax. And probably a million leaves sailed on their strange stalks as the crickets ticked together. And I, in my brand new body, which was not a woman's yet, told the stars my questions, and thought God could really see the heat and the painted light, elbows, knees, dreams, good night. Isn't that nice? It's one sentence. The whole poem is a single sentence. For those of you who didn't see it in the book, it looks like this. It's probably 20 lines long. And it's all a single sentence with all the images of the place kind of jumbled together. And the house, if you'd read it, we could talk about it. If you had it sitting in front of you, that's what's frustrating when you talk about poetry, not to have it sitting in front of you to look at. I'll read it again. I think you need to hear poems several times, so let me just read it again. And as I do, you might want to think about the imagery that she's using and how she's using that imagery to create her mood. A thousand doors ago, when I was a lonely kid in a big house with four garages, and it was summer as long as I could remember, I lay on the lawn at night, clover wrinkling under me, the wise stars bedding over me, my mother's window, a funnel of yellow heat running out, my father's window, half shut, an eye where sleepers pass, and the boards of the house were smooth and white as wax, and probably a million leaves sailed on their strange stalks as the crickets ticked together, and I, in my brand new body, which was not a woman's yet, told the stars my questions and thought God could really see the heat and the painted light, elbows, knees, dreams. Good night. As you listen to it, what stands out in your mind?
The contrast between the mother's window and the father's window.
Isn't that interesting? What do you think she's saying through that contrast, or what effect does it have on you?
I think when I went back and reread the line again, I still didn't really quite understand the image of the father's window, but the impression it gave me was one of warmth and the invitation to the mother's window, and just the opposite to the father's.
What was the father's line again? What was that about?
My father's window half shut, an eye where sleepers pass. Which is an odd line, really. An eye where sleepers pass. It's not clear what the verb is doing in there, what it means when it says that sleepers pass, but it clearly is an eye, and it's half shut. So it does seem to be shutting her out, doesn't it? Or at least halfway shutting her out. And the contrast between that and the mother's, where it's my mother's window, a funnel of yellow heat running out. I mean, if you knowing nothing about Anne Sexton's life, what would you guess would be her relationship with her mother and father?
Mother definitely much stronger than her father.
It's interesting, the doors and the windows both. It seems like that's, you know, that's sort of an image that runs through that first part.
Yes, a thousand doors ago. Isn't that an interesting image? You've got the exaggeration of a thousand years ago, but it's not a thousand years ago, it's a thousand doors ago. What does that do for you?
A lot of coming and going.
A lot of comings and goings.
It puts a lot of distance to her remembering.
It puts a lot of distance between her and the memory. Yeah. She's done a lot since then, hasn't she? It's not just that time has passed, but that comings and goings and ins and outs have passed.
And it kind of goes with the image, too, of that big house. It sounds like it was a big house with lots of rooms.
Right.
And four garages.
And four garages,
so
right.
So I put those two right. things together.
Doesn't it... It seems to me that Sexton has a genius for being able to see with a child's eye. What does a child remember about this house? Is the four garages. Just how extraordinary it was to have four garages. I also think that it's an interesting illustration of characteristics of poetry, that we're able to get a picture of her relationship with her mother and father from those two images. You know, it's just very condensed and economical.
And the fact that there were two windows says something about the relationship between the mother and father.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And her outside. That the mother and father are in the big white house, and she's outside, looking in. And the mother's window is funneling heat, not light, but heat, yellow heat, running out. And the father's is an eye that's halfway shut. And we know it's got a door. Is the house beginning to look like a face? Listen to this. The boards of the house were smooth and white as wax. So we've got something that's almost like a face. And she's outside of it. It was summer as long as I could remember. Boy, that made me 10 years old. Just that. It was summer as long as I could remember. Don't you wish it would be summer as long as you could remember now? What else? What other images strike you in the poem? Do you want to hear it again, or do you remember it?
Hear it again.
Want to hear it again? Okay. 1,000 doors ago, when I was a lonely kid in a big house with four garages, and it was summer as long as I could remember, I lay on the lawn at night, clover wrinkling under me, the wise stars bedding over me. My mother's window, a funnel of yellow heat running out. My father's window, half shut, an eye where sleepers pass. And the boards of the house were smooth and white as wax, and probably a million leaves sailed on their strange stalks as the crickets ticked together, and I, in my brand new body, which was not a woman's yet, told the stars my questions and thought God could really see the heat and the painted light, elbows, knees, dreams. Good night. What did you hear this time?
The image you used of the clover being wrinkled during gave you, you could feel it not being smooth. You could feel it being bumpy underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And when the stars bedding?
Bedded, so yes, bedded. Right.
When you were a kid, you never had a feeling that the stars, there was depth.
Mm-hmm.
It was more like a blanket
mm-hmm.
over one layer.
Yeah, that's really nice that the stars are her cover, aren't they? They're her bedding, and they are themselves bedding. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that caught the gawkiness of the knees and elbows not yet being old.
Yes.
Not fully formed yet.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that lovely? And it's so economical because you can remember being at an age when your body's growing unevenly and you're all elbows and knees, and I picture her sitting sort of like this with her knees drawn up and her arms circling them and her new body, not yet a woman's body.
That painted light was a funny image,
and
I couldn't...
Isn't
it? The heat might refer back to the mother's window, but the painted light, I almost wondered if that referred back to the father's window, or
it doesn't seem to, does it? Since his is an eye that's half shut, it makes it seem unreal, doesn't it? It's not like it's real light. It's light that's sort of painted on.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder.
Can you make a picture?
There's also the wax in this.
Right.
House.
That's so right.
Yeah.
That's right. So the house is kind of like a candle in a sense, isn't it? With the heat funneling out and the painted light. Sort of. I visualize it as a big white house with no lights on except in this one window. And the light streaming out, and you can see the rays of, you know, you can see real sharply the way the light slants down so that it looks painted. What else struck you on hearing it the third time?
I get kind of a lonely feeling Did she say lonely? She said the lonely house.
When I was a lonely kid, yes.
Oh,
a thousand doors ago,
when I was a lonely kid. When she talks about in the summer, as long as I can remember, it must have been a long summer for her then.
It is a lonely feeling, isn't it? She's all by herself. She's lying out on the grass outside her parents' house, this big old house. Her father's sort of shutting her out. Her mother's funneling out the heat. It's a lonely feeling. Do you remember feeling lonely when you were a child? Do you remember what loneliness felt like?
It wasn't scary, but you didn't necessarily feel wrong or bad. Just quiet or removed or something, but not.
And just kind of a feeling of being on the outside of things, that she's on the outside of the house and the parents on the inside.
Watching, so stepping back and watching.
I remember that feeling. I remember the feeling. I was an only child. And I remember the feeling that my parents were the insiders and I was somehow rather the outsider, and that was something that it was impossible to break into.
And yet at the same time, I got kind of a feeling of a connection with the nature around her and understanding stars and thinking that God could understand too.
I did too, yes. Right, that's why I liked your remark that it's not a sad or a scary kind of loneliness. It's a blending into everything kind of loneliness, that the stars are there for her and the wrinkling clover is there for her, the earth underneath, the sky above, and God watching, elbows, knees, dreams, good night. There's a couple of little things she does in here that you may or may not have picked up as I read them that are nice little techniques to support what's going on. One is the line, "The million leaves sailed on their strange stalks." And that sibilant S sound that gives you the maple, you know, those maple seeds or the maple leaves just circling down and sailing. And then the crickets tick together. Just some little bit of onomatopoeia there that makes the cricket sound going together. So it's nice, and she brings in just the sounds and the almost the whooshing of the night. Nice poem. Let me read you another one, which is also a childhood magic poem. This one is by Mae Swenson. I mistakenly said Mae Sarton, but it's Mae Swenson. It's called The Centaur, and it's a little longer. I'll read it through once, and you can think about it, and then I'll read it through again. It's done in stanzas, which are made up of three lines each, and the final stanza, which resolves the story, has four lines.
What's it called?
It's called the centaur. You know the centaur, the mythical beast that's a horse's body and a human head? This is another one of those endless summer poems. The summer that I was 10, can it be that there was only one summer that I was 10? It must have been a long one then. Each day I'd go out to choose a fresh horse from my stable, which was a willow grove down by the old canal. I'd go on my two bare feet, but when with my brother's jackknife I had cut me a long, limber horse with a good thick knob for a head, and peeled him slick and clean except for a few leaves for the tail, and cinched my brother's belt around his head for a rein, I'd straddle and canter him fast up the grass bank to the path, trot along in the lovely dust that talcumed over his hoofs, hiding my toes and turning his feet to swift half moons. The willow knob with the strap jouncing between my thighs was the pommel, and yet the pole of my nickering pony's head. My head and my neck were mine, yet they were shaped like a horse. My hair flopped to the side like the mane of a horse in the wind. My forelock swung in my eyes, my neck arched, and I snorted. I shied and skittered and reared, stopped and raised my knees, pawed at the ground and quivered. My teeth bared as we wheeled and swished through the dust again. I was the horse and the rider, and the leather I slapped to his rump spanked my own behind. Doubled, my two hoofs beat a gallop along the bank. The wind twanged in my mane, my mouth squared to the bit, and yet I sat on my steed, quiet, negligent riding, my toes standing the stirrups, my thighs hugging his ribs. At a walk, we drew up to the porch. I tethered him to a paling. Dismounting, I smoothed my skirt and entered the dusky hall. My feet on the clean linoleum left ghostly toes in the hall. "Where have you been?" said my mother. "Been riding," I said from the sink, and filled me a glass of water. "What's that in your pocket?" she said. "Just my knife." It weighed my pocket and stretched my dress awry. "Go tie back your hair," said my mother. "And why is your mouth all green?" "Rob Roy, he pulled some clovers. We crossed the field," I told her. Someone enjoyed it.
Yeah. I like that last line.
I do too, yes. What strikes you from it, just hearing it once?
Cheerful.
Mm-hmm.
Happy.
It's a very happy memory of childhood, isn't it? What sort of girl does she seem to have been?
Wild, self-willed. I mean, she just, it's almost like she was giving her mother stats when she said, "Oh, Rob Roy."
Now she calls herself Rob Roy. And she gives her mother some sass at the end. Do you want me to read it again? Do you need to hear it again, or do you remember it well enough to talk about? Okay. The summer that I was 10, can it be there was only one summer that I was 10? It must have been a long one then. Each day, I'd go out to choose a fresh horse from my stable, which was a willow grove down by the old canal. I'd go on my two bare feet, but when with my brother's jackknife I had cut me a long, limber horse with a good thick knob for a head, and peeled him slick and clean except for a few leaves for the tail, and cinched my brother's belt around his head for a rein, I'd straddle and canter him fast up the grass bank to the path, trot along in the lovely dust that talcumed over his hoofs, hiding my toes and turning his feet to swift half-moons. The willow knob, with the strap jouncing between my thighs, was the pommel and yet the pole of my nickering pony's head. My head and my neck were mine, yet they were shaped like a horse. My hair flopped to the side like the mane of a horse in the wind. My forelock swung in my eyes. My neck arched and I snorted. I shied and skittered and reared, stopped and raised my knees, pawed at the ground and quivered, my teeth bared as we wheeled and swished through the dust again. I was the horse and the rider, and the leather I slapped to his rump spanked my own behind. Doubled, my two hoofs beat a gallop along the bank. The wind twanged in my mane. My mouth squared to the bit, and yet I sat on my steed, quiet, negligent riding, my toes standing the stirrups, my thighs hugging his ribs. At a walk, we drew up to the porch. I tethered him to a paling. Dismounting, I smoothed my skirt and entered the dusky hall. My feet on the clean linoleum left ghostly toes in the hall. "Where have you been?" said my mother. "Been riding," I said from the sink and filled me a glass of water. "What's that in your pocket?" she said. "Just my knife." It weighed my pocket and stretched my dress awry. "Go tie back your hair," said my mother. "And why is your mouth all green?" "Rob Roy, he pulled some clover as we crossed the field," I told her. Anything jump out at you the second time?
The phrase horse, she was a horse and a rider. That seems, I'm not quite sure what she meant by that.
Okay, what picture do you have of what's going on?
I have a picture of her riding through the field on her little horse thing, but I just wonder what she's symbolically meant by doing.
Both the horse and the rider? Mm-hmm. So she's riding on this willow stick. Everybody's got a picture of that, right? She's cut the willow stick and she's riding on it and she's holding on to it and she's going across the fields. And if you listen, if you look carefully at the poem, what you see is that at the very beginning of it, she's herself and she's going out and she's cutting a willow stick. And she's conscious of what she's doing. She's conscious of the pretense. But as the poem goes along, the pretend becomes real. She believes that she really is, or she writes it as though she really were, both horse and rider.
When she talks about the hooves and the feet,
right.
She interchanges.
That's right.
Within about 2 months.
That's right, and it's almost like that's the point of transformation. I was just looking there. I'd straddle and canter him fast. So here she still is the rider. Up the grass bank. You know, if you're in bare feet and you're going on your toes or the front halves of your feet through the dust, what you then have left is something that looks sort of like a horseshoe after the toes are talcumed over. So the dust comes and is like a magic dust and transforms the footprints into a horse's hoof prints. And then the willow knob with the strap jouncing between my thighs was the pommel and yet the pole. Now, I don't know about horses. What's a pommel and what's a pole?
Isn't the pommel kind of the knob at the top of a saddle?
Okay. Yeah. And what's the pole?
That would be the stick, of course.
Well, it says it was the pommel and yet the pole of my nickering pony's head. So is a pole part of a pony's head? Oh, well.
Maple leaf forest, you have a pole, you know.
Well, it's P-O-L-L. Oh. That's what you can't see.
I see.
Well, actually, you know, now that you mention that, it works as a pun, doesn't it? Because whatever a pole is, the pole might just be the top of the pony's head, but it works as a pun. It's both the pole and the pole, and the word transforms it, so the word becomes the hinge there. And then now she's sort of laying it out. My head and my neck were mine, so she's herself. Yet they were shaped like a horse. So here she becomes the horse, too. And you picture her hair swinging to the side. I haven't got long enough hair to do it, but you'd have to swing your hair to the side like a mane. And my forelock swung in my eyes, so it's not even, at first she uses the simile, my hair was like a mane, and then she moves into the metaphor, my forelock, so that the hair, she's become the horse. And the poetry, in a sense here, the language is making the transformation. My neck arched and I snorted. And then you get into this whole series of verbs of what she does as the horse. And you can just picture this girl, can't you? Having an absolutely wonderful time. In fact, even more than picture her, what I think the poem does is it puts you in her place. So you can be her. I snorted, I shied, and skittered and reared, stopped and raised my knees, pawed at the ground and quivered. My teeth bared as we wheeled and swished through the dust again. And then we get to that line. So that she's gone through the series of verbs of what she's done. She's completed the transformation. And then we get to the line, I was the horse and the rider. So what do you make of that? If she's the horse and the rider, what does it suggest to you or make you question?
Well, like you said before, she's becoming, her pretend is becoming this, or her pretend.
What does the horse represent to her? What does it seem to mean?
Freedom?
Yeah.
I think freedom's a real good suggestion for that it's...
Would the horse and the rider really be the ultimate freedom, because you not only have the freedom of a horse's freedom, but then you also, the rider that's guiding the horse too.
Mm-hmm. It would be, wouldn't it? You have both. You have both the control and the power. Both the direction and the energy. Both the body and the soul. Mm-hmm. The body and the mind. So you have not only freedom, but also, it seems to me, power. That's a beautiful image of that, and of the freedom of childhood. And she is 10, and 10 just seems to be a critical age there. That's why when you were doing the fantasy, I asked you to imagine being 10. What's 10? What happens when you're 10? Or what hasn't happened when you're 10? Boy, you haven't quite got the hormones yet, have you?
You're not in high school yet. I mean, you're starting to think about what high school is. You're still a year or two off, but you know that the high school, the big kids, they call them big kids, they go to a different school.
Mm-hmm. Seems like 10 is almost the perfect age to be, because you're at the peak of being a child. You're top of the kids, and you've got all the freedom and imaginative resources of the child, and you're not yet an adolescent. You're not yet at the point where it matters to you that your dress is awry, or where it matters to you that your mouth is green. Those things just don't count yet. Your mother tries to get you to pay attention to them, but they really don't count. What counts is the horse and the rider, where you're still one. I mean, that image of being the horse and the rider is a real image of wholeness and integrity, isn't it? Of being both things. Whereas so often, by the time people get to be adolescents, you aren't the horse and the rider anymore. You're putting on makeup and getting dressed up and being the desirable object for somebody else, but you're not the horse and the rider anymore. So there's something marvelous and magical for girls about that moment of being 10. And I think the poem does that in a real nice way in the way she ends it. At a walk, we drew up to the porch, my feet on the clean linoleum left ghostly toes in the hall. But they're toes now. They're not hoof prints anymore once she's in the house. And then the mother comes in with her questions. And listen to the mother's questions. Where have you been? What's that in your pocket? Go tie back your hair. So what does the mother seem to represent in her life?
Reality.
Yeah, it is a kind of reality check, isn't it? It's, what else is it besides reality? Or what is the reality?
The moving force. The mother's reinforcing, you know, you've got to take care of your looks, you know. What have you been up to? You've got to account for yourself. You've got to make sure your hair is tied. You know, why is your mouth clean?
Mm-hmm.
She's beginning to start that change where the girl is going to look after herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, yeah.
Limits, true.
Limits, sure. It's not just what's socially acceptable, but it's you have to account for yourself. You can't go off and play. I mean, that's part of the tragedy of losing childhood is that it's no longer as easy just to go off and play. That we grow into believing that we have to be productive, you know, or serious, or something, or we're forced into it. We have work to do, we have chores to do, we have to get a job, we have to get, be responsible for ourselves.
One real interesting thing was that whole thing about her brother's knife and her brother's belt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when the mother asks about the knife, she said, my knife.
Yeah, right.
Which was a real kind of interesting, you know, it was just not on the main thread, but it was kind of a touch that I sort of wondered about.
Yeah, I think that's a very nice observation, that what the ride has transformed that knife into her knife.
Well, that's okay. That's what...
And she's owning it now. It's not just her brothers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like the whole idea that this was a ritual. It was a fantasy that she repeated and went back to.
Yes. Yes.
It has something to do with that age, too, that you don't always do. Mm-hmm. You establish a way of playing that you go back and repeat and then start the same game with your friends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are games that you have with your friends and there are games that you have all by yourself that you do like this one. That you play by yourself. But yeah, ritual is very important in childhood, isn't it? All kinds of rituals. And we have different ones as adults. And they're more sort of purposeful, I guess, than the rituals we had as kids. The other poem that I wanted to read today to talk about childhood is by Nikki Giovanni, who's a black woman. This is called Nikki-Rosa, and I don't know what that means. It may be that Rosa is another one of her names, or maybe Rosa is her sister who's mentioned in the poem. But anyway, this one goes like this. Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, they never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself and how good the water felt when you got in your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings as the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference. but only that everybody is together, and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me, because they never understand black love is black wealth, and they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy. Do you connect with anything in that? Do you need to hear it again before you talk about it? Hear it again? Okay. Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, they never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself and how good the water felt when you got your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings as the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me, because they never understand black love is black wealth. And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy.
I think it's kind of odd, because in the beginning it sounds like she thinks it's a drag, you know, that what was that?
Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet.
I guess I felt at first. I didn't understand it, I guess. I thought at first she was saying it was a drag, but then in the end it was more happy or something. She said it was more happy.
It is confusing, isn't it? I wonder if she made it deliberately confusing this way. Because it starts out saying that the remembrances are a drag because of what you remember. You remember living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. But then she kind of shifts the turf a little bit. And she says, if you become famous or something. And you have to assume that she wrote this after she became famous or something.
Yeah.
Unless she's got a rich fantasy life. They never talk about how happy you were. So that sort of shifts it from being your own remembrances to being remembrances that are coming from the outside. And I think that that's the point of view that she maintains through the rest of the poem, is the remembrances that other people have about you, about your life, the way that other people interpret your life.
You must feel like that's purposeful, though, that maybe it's saying, you know, that there's a little both there. The fact that you were happy, but yet at the beginning she is at least.
You change as an adult. You judge your memories, or you judge the situation, and instead of remembering how it felt, you look back, and if your dad was unemployed, you might be judgmental about that. Whereas a kid, if he was home all day with you, that's what, you know.
I think that's really true. It's as though, as adults, we look back at our childhoods not from inside ourselves, almost, but from outside ourselves. So it's sort of like looking back at your own childhood is looking at it from somebody else's point of view, in a way. And maybe the poem is partly a way of her reminding herself what it felt like to be a child, rather than just looking back at it.
I think it's interesting, she thinks that because she's black, that people would look on things like that. That's an easy thing for anyone who's been poor, and they say, nothing to do with being black. My mother went through the depression when she talked about that, and she said, you know, we were poor, but we were happy, you know, we needed, all we needed. I never remember being in want of anything. Seems to me a lot of people could identify with that and not be black.
I think so, too. Not being black, it's hard. It's hard to say no. That we feel the same way, because I don't know if we do feel exactly the same way. But I think it certainly is a situation that many, many people can identify with. You know, one of the things I was going to ask you to do is imagine that someone's writing your biography. What do you think they'd say about your childhood? Sure, if you'd like to.
We moved a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And moved across the country. And I guess when I look back on that, a lot of people would thing that's real tough. I said it was like this, you know, that a lot of ways when your family was the center, that was big adventures, like when we were moving to that big house that had the attic. Oh, when we were in about third grade, I mean, we were so excited about this house with the big attic, and somehow those changes were high adventure up until before the senior year in high school, you know. But I think, you know, we look at from the outside and people say, oh, isn't that a shame you spent 2 years in one school and 3 years in another and 1 year in another. And the time that wasn't, it was kind of like the fact that you were all together and that there were somehow there was security in that.
Yeah. What about other people? Can you think about?
I think it would depend on who was the person who was writing, how much they knew about you or your family, or what perspective they were writing. If they were just looking at the facts, that would be a totally different picture than actually talking to you and finding out how you felt about it and so on.
Yeah, I think that's really true, that it depends on the extent to which the person's willing to talk to you. But if they were just looking at the facts, what do you think they'd make of the facts of your childhood?
I think it would be kind of, I grew up on a farm alone. I was an only child. And when I was five, my dad got sick with a sickness that he eventually died from, so he became increasingly incapacitated. So I would say that they would get a negative impression of my life, you know, but they had a very happy home together, you know, like security, and there were many good things that they would miss the Nazi.
So that you could imagine the story of your life being told as a tragedy, or as an adventure, or as a heartwarming family comedy, you know, depending on how it's looked at. Poor only child and spends deprived childhood on family farm.
And sometimes you know, I think of it like that too. Sometimes.
Right, exactly.
It makes sense.
Right. It gets all mixed up. What about other people? What do you think that your biographer would say about your childhood?
I saw them moving too, because my dad worked for the Army. Mm-hmm. But also, I think my family, we had a lot of restrictions. My parents were very strict and required a lot of us as far as helping around the home and so on. And, I know just how some of my friends looked at it, but knowing that with that went a lot of trust too, that we got a lot of freedom because of the responsibility we handled and earned us a lot of freedom. But I can see it from our perspective. That would maybe give me too much responsibility for my age or something.
Well, I think that one thing to sort of light on before we finish is, as a result of this discussion, sort of growing out of this discussion, a sense that what an artist does is to make something of an experience. Not just to report on the experience, not just to record the experience, but to make something of it. And what Nikki Giovanni is saying, in a sense, is that you don't want someone else reporting on your experience or making what they want to make out of your experience, that you want to make it for yourself. But also what I think we've been saying is that you can make many different things of your experience. You can look at your own life and call it happy, or you can look at your life and call it deprived, you know, put upon, beleaguered, that you make yourself, that we create ourselves, and that we, you know, I think about the rituals that you were talking about in childhood, that rituals are a way of creating yourself and reminding yourself of who you are, and that the girl in the centaur is doing that in some ways. She's creating herself. She's creating that power for herself. And the poet, in writing the poem, is creating that power for her younger self, is reminding her younger self of who she was. And in many ways, the poet, the artist, creates it for all of us. Because reading that poem, we can all be 10 again. We can all be the horse and the rider together. We can all remember the feeling of lying, wrinkling the clover at night, lying outside, alone with God. being not yet in our woman's body. So what I'd like to close by doing is invite all of you to take your memories and make a poem out of them. And if you'd like to do that, and if you'd like to get together and share what you make, that would be fun too. Is anybody interested in trying that?
I would like to be interested. I'm scared.
It's scary. Yeah, it's very scary. Writing poetry is very scary because it's not something that you do very often, and it feels like it's something that only other people can do.
Right. Part of me wants to want to, but
another part of you doesn't want to want to.
I'd like to.
Would you like to? Well, why don't we try, or at least say that we'll try. And when do you want to get together? After breakfast tomorrow? Have a little poetry swap under the bell?
Could it be done in one day, though? I don't know if I...
Maybe later than breakfast. I don't have a chance to. This evening, my kids sort of take over.
Right. That's true. Mine do, too. After dinner?
After lunch.
Mm-hmm. What? Are people here till Friday?
Yeah, through Friday morning.
Yeah. Till Friday? How about Friday after breakfast, then?
Can you still be Friday?
No, I probably won't do it anyway.
Well, any poem that we write is better than no poem. You know? Anything you do is better than not doing anything at all.
You can tell that everybody is writing the same amount of experience.
Well, I'm not a poet. I feel apprehensive about it too, but I think that it would be fun to try, fun to share. The other thing for those of you who are going to be here is that the next session I'm going to do, which is also on Friday, and I don't remember at what time, is about adolescence. And this book is rich in adolescence stories, but the one that I particularly like and enjoy talking about is by Joyce Carol Oates. It's called Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? And it's I won't tell you anything about it until you get a chance to read it. And I'm perfectly willing to lend my book to anyone who'd like to read it, and if you'd like to pass it around, that would be fine. It's supposed to be on reserve in the library as well, and it's also going to be available in the bookstore.
Is it available in the bookstore?
Yeah, it is going to be available in the bookstore. So, thank you all. It was fun.
So Friday morning after breakfast?
Friday morning after breakfast, we'll share poems.
Yeah, that allows tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah. Right.
I want to get my class writing more poetry this year, and I've known for a long time that I can't really expect them to do it until I'm willing to try it myself. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I've always backed off teaching more poetry to my kids.
Mm-hmm. What age do you teach?
Sixth grade.
Oh, right. Yeah. But with sixth graders, maybe they can tap right into some...
Some do, but I see some that are like me.
Yeah.
That if I just feel like I'd be able to encourage them to do more risk-taking.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot with journals this year, and I think that's a good way to start.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Let me just get some feedback from you. How was this session for you? Did it meet your needs? Was it... It was
really fun.
Yeah.
It
would have been nice to have just...
Is there a copy machine?
I don't believe there is a copying machine available to us.
Okay.
I asked if I could even type the poems and duplicate them, and I was told that duplication is simply out of the question. So people need to go to the library and get the book, or go to the bookstore and get the book.
Well, poems, I think, were short enough to, after you read them a couple of times.
Yeah, it worked real. It was kind of nice.
And just having the book available, because Mary Ann and I both read it, she had to leave.
Mm.
Passing her book in that house, too.
Good. I was impressed with how much you all were able to pick up from the poems just on hearing them. Because I'm so visual that I'm sort of stuck on having it right in front of me so that I can see it.
Well, it's interesting because I've never been real comfortable with poetry, and somehow just listening to it makes me think I should take poems out on tape or something, because I really... relaxed and listened to it better. I think I wasn't intimidated the way I sometimes am. If I look down, there's lines of
right.
verse.
Right.
Yeah, you were trying to figure out every word you were going for impression.
Right.
Yeah, it really
right.
was. It makes me think maybe what I need to do for a while is listen to some poetry.
That's a very, very interesting insight. It really is.
Kids too, I found that they like symbolism. Just like in drawing, they get stuck on, when they're little, way of drawing a house, you mm-hmm. draw the same way. And they get really stuck on the form of poetry
mm-hmm.
and how many lines it should have and, mm-hmm. and how it should look. And so if you can avoid that by letting them hear it first, they don't get as hung up on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think poetry is very intimidating to most people. And
but some poetry is, you know, is more interesting than others.
Sure.
I think we don't read enough poetry to our kids. When we're, mm-hmm. we read a lot of stories and folktales, but not much poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to really be comfortable hearing something before mm-hmm. you can enjoy reading it.
Mm-hmm. And most of what there is available for children is very rhymey and jingly and
Shel Silver Stein stuff.
Yeah, which is fine.
It's kind of fun.
And it's
yeah.
fun.
Yeah.
But it's still, my children will then look at something like that doesn't have rhymes and they'll say it's not poetry.
Boring.
Or it's boring.
We read a lot in our family together. Would this be a good book to do with a family or not?
I think there are stories in here that would be fine.
And poetry.
And poetry as well, mm-hmm. that would be fine to do as a family. Some of the stuff as you get into adult issues and old age and death issues probably would be a little sophisticated. For the children, but some of the poems would be good.
There are some good poetry books you can think of for kids. Anthology, I think.
Yeah. We have one that's really beautiful. It has a navy blue, kind of bright blue. It has beautiful, it's really for young kids, mm-hmm. and has a really wonderful picture that has a big mixture of,
mm-hmm.
It's a big book about like the,
mm-hmm.
about that. That
mm-hmm.
And it has some that are rhymed and
mm-hmm.
some that aren't. And it was helpful for me. No, that's one for teenagers, Keep in Touch, that they have over here. That's
mm-hmm.
very safe.
Mm-hmm.
But that one is just the pictures are so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That it sort of draws me in
mm-hmm.
and draws kids in. But
it's hard, once they get stuck on Silverstein, it's hard to
yeah.
get them off that.
Mm-hmm.
They
yeah.
enjoy that.
Sort of like sugar.
Uh-huh.
Good. Well, let's go have dinner.